please enjoy this previously recorded segment.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez from Verrill, and today our guest is Matt Ball, Vice President, Head of Workplace at Financial Health Network. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Tani. Always a pleasure to connect with you again.
I am very much looking forward to this conversation because today Matt and I are talking about the importance of a livable wage and how that correlates to employee wellness more generally. A very broad topic. So with that, I want to jump directly into it. And I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are saying, wait a second, Tani, usually you spend 3 to 5 minutes just chatting and hearing yourself talk. But I think that there's enough to talk about here, Matt, that I actually want to turn it right over to you. And while you've been a guest on the show before, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of hearing you before?
Sure. Well, I'm a recovering labor and employment lawyer, so there's hope for you, Tani. Former attorney at Verrill Law. I am from the great state of Colorado, but by love, I've moved to Maine, and this is now my adopted home state. I worked at Bath Iron Works in labor relations. I was in human resources at Maine Health. I was an executive at Prudential Financial, and am now working at a nonprofit think tank, the Financial Health Network, whose mission is really to improve financial health for all. And we really approach that looking at financial health and well-being really from an ecosystem perspective. So that includes the financial services market, as well as the work that I lead, which is looking at the role that employers in the workplace can play. So my career has been nonlinear. It has been a passion project. And I know I've been on the show before and have had conversation with David, and he's given me counsel off mic of like, you got to stay in a place longer than 2 years. It's like, I just keep, you know, quitting upwards. So I don't know. I think, you know, to all those that rely on David for career advice, he's outstanding, but I'm an anomaly in that sense. But I think it's really been just a journey of my background as a, you know, going to a liberal arts college, really enjoying learning, liking to do new things, and really continuing in my own career evolution to really focus on the paramount importance of not only treating workers with respect and dignity, but ensuring that we are providing a greater proportion of financial support to workers who undergird so much of our economy, who undergird so much of the role that we play as a country. And I think that's a topic that I never get tired of talking about. So I'm glad the audience could hear me blather for a few minutes instead of you. Is a nice change of pace.
Absolutely. So for those of you who made the connection, Matt and I have known each other, gosh, for almost a decade now, but we spent some time together at Verrill while he was there. So, and then since then, we've presented and talked and stayed in touch on all things human resources and now financial in matter as well. I mean, Financial Health Network's mission seems super broad. So for a lot of listeners, they're saying, well, what does that mean? Is it something that can help me and my company? It's a nonprofit. So is it really just working with other nonprofits? Or let our listeners know a little bit about, like, is Financial Health Network and what the organization does something that everyone can use? Or is there a segment of the population or a segment of organizations in the financial industry that rely upon it?
Yeah, it's a great question because we do a lot. And I think that's more of a reflection of the fact that the financial lives of consumers and employees is not limited to one sphere. And so the way that we partner is we are a membership-based organization. So we have about 170 members, large financial service, most of the big banks, as well as record keepers, retirement providers, and a growing number of employers. Our employer partners range from Fortune 5 companies to small companies here in the state of Maine. And so really, we're a place for anybody who is interested in learning more and advancing the role of financial health and well-being for whatever constituency they're focused on. We do that. We also do work through an innovation lab. So we work with a lot of early stage fintechs as we continue to see just the proliferation of technology as a means to address financial challenges, adding new benefits, adding new concepts, adding new solutions to the marketplace constantly. We also have a consulting practice where we do direct work with organizations. We don't do work with the consumer base itself. We're really an influence organization. So I do a work and my team does work with large employers, helping them build strategies, identify best practices, get in place measurement strategies to actually understand what their solutions do. We also work with benefit vendors. So the question, the answer is really, why wouldn't you want to affiliate with the Financial Health Network? Because we are nimble, we're flexible. And yes, we're a 501c3 nonprofit. And you know, we, again, really focus our work on helping to change the different ecosystems towards more financial health and well-being. There's been a rash of banks, for example, that have announced they're removing withdrawal and other fees from their accounts. That's not directly because of their work with us, but we have certainly been a part of that conversation, working with them, nudging them along the way. Another example would be the living wage conversations. We're deeply involved in that through some strategic partnerships and also working with some of our employer partners.
So I told you actually before the show started that I've spent the last couple of days just kind of digging in on your publications and the stuff that you've been up to for the last couple of years. And you recently wrote an article that was entitled, Is the Great Resignation Really a Great Reprioritization? So first, I love that title, whether you came up with it or you have a brilliant marketing team, either one, kudos to them or you. But in the article, you noted you can't separate work and income from well-being and mental and physical health, which are as essential to thriving as paying rent. What do you mean by this statement? Kind of, is it just, yeah, people need money in order to pay rent, or kind of, is it deeper than that?
It's certainly deeper than that. I mean, that's a really practical example of how it manifests in the real world. But there's a growing body of excellent literature, studies, and also just practical experience that helping people be financially resilient, helping them ensure they can afford the basic needs of their life is an outstanding way in which for them to actually improve their overall health and well-being. I would point your listeners and others to the work of Dr. Carrie Liana at the University of Pittsburgh. She's done some amazing longitudinal studies on the impact of financial strain driven by sort of lack of sufficient funds, savings, et cetera. And not only is that research really pointing to the ability for improved financial stability to not only lift people's lives, making them easier to afford the basic essentials, but it also actually has the power to continue to change our cognitive function. And what I mean by that is there's a number of studies that have shown that people that live in high financial strain or financial precarity are cognitively deficient in the sense that their brain chemistry, because of the impact of that strain, prohibits them from actually performing at higher levels, from being as productive, from being as the ability to make the right sort of informed decisions. Those same individuals, once they are able to lift out of that financial precarity, their actual cognitive function changes. And so this matters in the sense of not just how these are interconnected, but just the role that increasing financial stability can play in all of our lives. The other aspect of this is certainly with the mental health. And I don't want to mislead anyone to say that, oh, if you just give people enough money, their mental health will disappear. That's absolutely not the case. But we have consistently seen that financial strain is one of the lead accelerants and exacerbators of underlying mental health conditions, whether that's depression, anxiety, et cetera. So it's really just back to sort of, you know, psychology 101 and Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you're able to meet the daily basic needs of your life, and you have that solid financial footing, the rest of your life sort of allows you to pursue those things that are of value. It allows you to take more time to focus on your health. I think there's a misconception about that. And what we continually see is it's hard to convince someone to pay attention to their health when they're just worried about paying rent or they're just worried about what they're going to be able to eat. And so in the workplace, I think this manifests in some interesting ways, which is there are things employers can do on the financial benefits that they can't replicate on the health benefits. So I can't teleport someone to see their PCP every year to get an annual screening, but I can auto-enroll them in benefits that we know are going to have long-term value. I can look at the wages that they're making and understand based upon where they live, whether that's going to be sufficient for them to meet just their basic needs. And so there are things that are far more within an employer's control that I think have ripple effects towards the other aspects of health and well-being.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour radio show. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez, and today our guest is Matt Ball, Vice President, Workplace Market Lead at Financial Health Network. And today we're discussing the importance of a livable wage. We just talked about kind of the importance of reprioritization and how you can't separate income and work from mental and physical health. I feel as though some of our listeners may be responding to your last comment by saying, I can increase the wages of my employees. I can pay everyone $30, $50, $60 an hour, right? And depending on their location, that might be a lot. It might still be at the low end of the spectrum, but it doesn't change how people spend their money. So isn't this a problem that our educational system should be dealing with? And why is it on an employer? Again, you know, we find ourselves, I think, dissimilar from a lot of other countries where we put a lot of the responsibility on employers and not other members of our community.
Yeah, it's a fair question. And the answer is, as you would imagine, it's complex and financial health is complex. So absolutely, we need to be doing more in helping people develop those behaviors and habits that allow them to also, you know, have financial security. You know, in the work that we do, you know, we have done longitudinal studies of the financial health of the U.S. population. And while income plays a key role, it is not in and of itself determinative of someone's financial health. In our most recent data, we saw that about 41% of people making $100,000 or more are not financially healthy. On the same time, about 17% of people making less than $60,000 a year are financially healthy. And so one way to maybe put this into context is we're actually to look at how the health and definitions of health have evolved. 50 years ago, health was defined as the absence of disease. We know now that health is about diet, it's about exercise, it's about choices, it's about behaviors, access to food, access to housing, community-based resources. And in the same way, financial health is the same thing. Financial health is not determinative in and of itself based upon wages, but we know that at the margins, it absolutely matters. And when we talk about what a living wage actually is, it is a minimum subsistence wage, right? It is providing people with enough money so they can afford housing, they can afford food, and they can meet their daily obligations. Doesn't talk about saving for retirement, doesn't talk about whether there's opportunities to make those decisions. I think we have to look at the education sector. We do work in that space. We have to look at healthcare. We do work in that space. We have to look at housing and other things that impact people's financial life, of course. Now, to your point about the role that employers, the basic building block of financial health is income. And without any income, there is no possibility of moving towards any semblance of financial health and well-being. So yeah, I do think it's fair to say that employers probably in this moment have an outsized role to play because they are the ones that have the largest control over the input of financial health. It's not to say they're the only ones and we need to have partnerships when looking at policy and other aspects, but I think any employer that would say to themselves, well, this isn't our problem, is just not living in reality. And it's probably a reason why they're, you know, experiencing the biggest crunch of this great resignation moment, because workers are just no longer satisfied with poverty level wages and being in a work environment where they don't feel they're treated with respect. And again, that's not to say that no wages are not respectful, but I don't think we can wrap all of this up without understanding that if employers aren't willing to pay their role, you're not going to have an impact in those other sectors.
So I think that there's some listeners who are probably thinking when they saw the title of today's show and they've heard the beginning of this discussion is the solution legislation, which I think historically, I mean, you just talked about the evolution of a healthy person and how the definition in the past has been one thing and now is another thing. When we talk about livable wages, I think in the past, we've presumed that that's something that was legislated. That's why we have a minimum wage, is to make sure everyone's on the same playing field. You see the Department of Labor when they issue fines and other slaps on the wrist saying, well, it's our goal that everyone has the same playing field. Is this something that needs to just be legislated, or is it something that employers need to independently just shift and provide to employees?
I think we have learned, if anything we've learned over the last 20 years of our politics, is waiting for Washington to act is a never-ending waiting game. And so, obviously policy matters, and setting particularly the floors around compensation matters. I think you're seeing this happen, not necessarily at the federal level, but you're seeing more state jurisdictions. You're seeing red states, even like Florida, that overwhelmingly voted for a $15 minimum wage to be set. So to me, like paying a living wage or thinking about those things, while it's easy for that to get sucked into sort of the political morass, it seems to me that we have very few things in this country that there's more consensus around than paying people enough money to live a basic life. And so, employers certainly play a key role in that. I think employers are doing that unilaterally. We're seeing across the market that wages are rising because of worker shortages. So there's certainly market pressures that are moving more organizations to change their wage structures. And I think that's going to be a trend that continues as people do that, and as more workers are looking for that sort of wage stability. But long-term, you're going to need some policy actions to ensure that you're setting that appropriate floor. I think the reality is, like, I don't know of virtually any employers that are paying the federal minimum wage. And so I think there are policy arguments you could make about whether the federal government is the best place and most efficient place. At scale it is, but I just don't see any political will or momentum to actually address that. And so in the interim, I think we are left with the market sort of evolving and setting that, and recognizing that paying a higher wage, it's our most immediate path forward. Is it the long-term solution? Remains to be seen, but I don't think we should wait and hold our breath to see what Washington does before organizations take their own workforce and put their own value into that, and really decide this is what we're going to do because it's the right thing for our business and it's the right thing for our people.
With that, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-law.com. I'm your host, Tani Alvarez from Verrill, and today our guest is Matt Ball, Vice President, Workplace Market Lead at Financial Health Network. And today we're discussing the importance of a livable wage and how an employer plays a role in helping employees be financially stable, I think would be a good way to describe it. You know, prior to the break, Matt, you mentioned the importance of kind of market evolution and market pressures. In a recent article, you talked about enlightened post-pandemic workers. Let's talk a little bit about, are they the ones who are going to force this shift? Or is it something that you foresee that we're going to see employers just change because it's the right thing to do, as opposed to the market forces an evolution of how we treat our workforce?
Yeah, I think, I don't have a crystal ball, so it's hard to sort of forecast that. But what I can tell you is, that I live in Rockland, Maine, and you can't walk by any of the restaurants downtown in Rockland without seeing, $16.50. Other wages that are far above what have been sort of the wage standards in particularly the retail and hospitality industries, which is where a vast majority of our country work, right? We have shifted away from a manufacturing-based economy towards a more service-based economy. And you're really seeing that start to manifest. So yes, I think the market pressures will certainly play a role in there. I think as workers are shifting their own priorities about what they want from their careers, what they want from work, that's going to have an impact. And you're really going to see that those industries and those work employers that are able to be responsive to that are going to be best positioned going forward. It's also fair to say that, you know, there's no, you know, unicorn solution that if you do X, Y will happen. Our economy is too complex. The workplace is too complex. There's far too many dynamics. But I think what we are seeing is that workers are just not satisfied with the same old, same old. And you can begrudge that. You can have, you know, opinions about that. You can fight against that. And that's all fair. And that's a business's prerogative. But understanding and listening to what workers are saying they need and really being responsive to that, I think is not only best practice in terms of supporting your workforce, but, you know, increasingly we're seeing that as businesses are trying to align their brands externally with the statements they're making, as the role of ESG from an investment perspective evolves, more investors are looking at the S in ESG is about how are you treating your people. We're seeing increased disclosure requirements from the federal government around human capital metrics. So this isn't going away for employers. And, you know, the employers that we work with, that we talk with, they're very attuned to how they treat their workforce influences how their brand is perceived in the market. And as our consumers become more enlightened about how organizations treat their workers, it's only going to continue to be a part of not just sort of the HR practices, but also the enterprise practices, because brand is such a premium in the marketplace today.
Do you see this shift as stemming from the pandemic, or is it from kind of a civil rights activism, general ESG, and the social aspect of how quickly information is available to individuals? Or is it more of a combination of all these forces that have come to a head to where we find ourselves now in early 2022?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of all of that. You know, when the work that, you know, the work that we do and sort of just really trying to understand, I mean, what we really encourage employers to do is to, you know, be intentional about listening to their workers. And that's not to say that an employer can do everything. That's just not practical. Even as we think about wage increases, the reality is increasing wages at the bottom of the scale has compression challenges and issues. And, you know, it's not as though you can just pay wages more at the bottom end of your scale and magically, you know, cure those problems. But what I think where I really anchor my work and where I really anchor and encourage employers to do is have a structured dialogue with your workforce and really understand what their needs are. I think there's an over-reliance on sort of, you know, survey systems and apparatuses that are inefficient and don't actually allow you to understand what workers are saying. I think there's no substitute for actually talking to your people. And not just to the same folks that you always want to talk to. And while that seems really basic, the companies, frankly, that I see doing the best work are those that have their senior leaders actively engaging in conversations with their frontline workers, regardless of the company size. And I think that's just a big gap that happens. And I think that foments a lot of mistrust. It foments a lot of misalignment of values. And organizations that have taken that seriously, I think, are performing well, and they're actually responsive to their workers. It's easier to tell to disappoint someone when they have a relationship with you and it's based on mutual trust and respect, as opposed to what can seem like arbitrary dictates. So I'm sure, Tana, you counsel your clients in similar veins about, you know, if you want to have a workplace culture that is exciting, that is attractive, it actually requires you to build that with intentionality. And it requires that the entire organization understands and has those conversation vectors open and available. I don't think it's rocket science in terms of doing that. I just think it requires a different approach and a different framing for how you actually view and treat your workers.
So interesting that you mentioned this, because before us getting on the call, and you might have mentioned, I say to people, you know, I have a face for radio, and in part, that's not just my visual appearance, but also my inability to maintain a facial expression during the course of an interview. And, you know, you mentioned surveys, and I cringed because this morning I was on a call and we were going over proposed survey questions for a nonprofit that I'm involved in. And I said, why are we asking this? What value does this add? And I think it's something organizations run into a lot. Okay, we need to gather data and information. And before they start that process, they're not asking themselves why. And I say it's not just a one why, it's a 3 to 5 why. So once you dig in there, why, what's the data? What are we going to do with the data once we collect it? Because we live in a time where it's easy to collect data. Is it good data, or how are we going to respond once we have the data becomes the more difficult thing. So making sure that we're getting the data that we want and that we can do something with becomes a bigger challenge. And I think it becomes part of, you know, what are people looking for? What does a healthy person look like? And for those of you who are regular listeners to HR Power Hour, you're probably thinking in your mind, wait a second, Tani, you had this conversation with Mike Vine at Wallet a couple of months ago about the fact that wellness really is different for every person, just like financial health is going to be very different for individuals based off of personal choices and experiences. So I love kind of this whole dialogue about who drives it and how employers play a role in what that looks like.
Yeah, I mean, I know Mike, I love Mike. They're doing some great stuff there at Wallet. I think he's a kindred spirit in the sense of, you know, improving employee wellness and well-being is good for business ultimately, as well as it's good for workers. I wholeheartedly subscribe to that. I think you're also a student pointing out that, well, let me back up. So HR data sucks. Like it stinks. It's siloed. It's, you know, different formats. Sometimes it's that vendor's house. It's a nightmare to work with. So
I promise you that in completing affirmative action programs, if you are listening right now and you are the person in your organization who is tasked with completing an affirmative action program, I am sure right now you are saying, absolutely, I 100% agree with that, because I have not worked with an organization who says, oh yeah, we're absolutely set up very easily for me just to give you the information necessary for us to understand where we are from an affirmative action standpoint.
Yeah, and even outside of the affirmative action context, the human capital management disclosures, since you've been reading and, you know, all of my articles, I'm sure you saw my human capital management article.
I have, and I want to talk about that after the next break. So I don't want you to jump into that. Yeah, I want to talk. Let's save that, because I have a ton of questions concerning HCM.
Yeah, I think we are certainly in a moment where, you know, and I think COVID accelerated a lot of things for organizations. Certainly the transformation in where and how we work continues to evolve. But I also think it opened a lot of employers' eyes into just the daily lives of their workers in a way that was really unprecedented. And I think what it's done is it's really demonstrated that the false barrier between work and life, I think a lot of employers talked about that sort of falsity. They never didn't really bear witness to it, and they bore witness to it. And I think that has certainly elevated the conversation. You are seeing more interest from the investor community around this ESG framework. I think there's a lot of work to still be doing in the ESG because at the end of the day, these businesses still have to generate profitable returns. You do have to think about the order of magnitude and the priorities and how you sort of set those things. But the idea of treating workers and prioritizing their well-being is not going to go away. In fact, we're just seeing more energy and more enthusiasm about this. And there's a real opportunity for employers to lead the charge and inform the way in which, you know, our corporate structures here in the U.S. can really support workers in a more humane, in a way that really values them and, frankly, aligns what they say publicly with the actions that they should be taking with their workforce.
I think a lot of times when we talk about employee health and both financial health, mental health, physical health, kind of all aspects of what health is. Burnout very quickly enters into the discussion. And when we're talking about burnout, we then talk about culturally, especially in the United States. If you're outside of the United States and you're listening to this show, welcome. But really kind of, I don't think this issue is only in the United States, but I think it's pretty bad here. That we talk about shorter work weeks. And I think I know a lot of employers respond with, hold up a second. You're asking us to increase wages and you're asking us to shorten the work week. Do you want all the jobs simply to be shifted overseas? Because based off of the current regulatory framework, we can't do business with shorter work weeks and higher pay. You know, what's the response to that?
I have great sympathy and empathy for that perspective because, we certainly have legal structures and rules that do make certain transformations harder. And so that's not something to be made light of, et cetera. That being said, you know, we have ample evidence or emerging evidence. I don't want to overstate it. And I think, researchers and fellows like Adam Grant, Daniel Pink, and others have starting to demonstrate that there are diminishing returns to productivity the more you work. And that's not because people don't want to work harder. It's simply because we're humans and fatigue is real. And our cognitive functions are better in the morning than they are in the evening for most people. And so grinding through past a certain point of work doesn't necessarily provide the returns that I think employers think they get if they can just grind out some more hours. I think we see this contributing to the burnout phenomenon, no doubt about it. Burnout, of course, originated in the healthcare industry and has now been, you know, sort of broadened to that. So yeah, I agree that like it's not ideal. We do have models in Europe where we've seen shorter work weeks that have yielded, you know, same levels of productivity. I don't know about you, but I also waste a lot of my time in things that aren't productive. I think Zoom has highlighted how much time we generally waste in meetings, this being an exception, of course, because we're really getting at the nitty gritty. So to me, it's one of these things where I think if we look at the hours that we spend on a basis, particularly in more of a managerial positions, I think we spend a lot of wasted time doing minutia that doesn't actually advance goals of an organization. And so I think one thing companies can do is just to look at and redesign their meeting programs and protocols. Are things more efficient over an email? Should we have more blackouts during the week where unless you're meeting externally, there's just no meeting so you can get work done? I think shift work certainly is more of a challenge to that because of some of the nature of shift work. But I don't think, I think we are seeing organizations that are tinkering with shorter work weeks, right? So healthcare most prominently, where you see 3-day schedules for 12 hours, you see other models that are emerging that shrink the work week while still maintaining some of that productivity. So I don't want this conversation to devolve to what's got to be an either or. I think we should be open to more imagination and more creativity and not simply rely that we have to have the same old five days, 8 hours a day, which by the way, is not how it works anyway in today's world. So why not think creatively about giving people the space they need to rejuvenate, making sure they're bringing their best selves to work, avoiding some of the burnout that is inevitable in any industry. So I push back on that to say that I hear that and I just say, well, that's just a lack of imagination. And it's a lack of really understanding how work is done, understanding how your workforce views this and understanding what's best for your people is also the same as what's best for your business. And if your business model is to generate more burnout, then I really would question whether or not you're actually needing more hours into that to improve those outcomes, or we need to reimagine what work matters most. How do we prioritize that? And how do we ensure we're putting people in positions to be successful?
Lots of things to consider there. And, you know, the good news is we're not going to come to any solutions in the course of just this one show. But I think a lot of things for all of us to think about. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go fish that!
Oh, come on! This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez. And for those of you who are just joining us today, our guest is Matt Ball, Vice President, Workplace Market Lead at Financial Health Network. And today we're discussing the importance of a livable wage and how that interrelates to happy and healthy employees. Prior to the break, Matt, you had been making reference to human capital disclosures, or HCD. For a lot of our listeners, they may be unaware of what that is. So can you explain what human capital disclosure rules are and kind of what that concept is?
Yeah, so it's a framework that was added to the 10K disclosure requirements for publicly traded companies. And within that, the SEC has promulgated some rules that require organizations, when they file their 10K, and again, this is for public companies only, that they disclose human capital management metrics. Now, they don't define what those metrics are. They provide some suggestive language. There's others that are out there, but it's a pretty squishy concept. The idea behind it is really to help investors and shareholders understand how organizations are investing in, promoting, and developing their, what many employers say in their price statement, is their most valuable asset, which is their workforce. And so I think there's increased recognition that the people matter in businesses, and shareholders and regulators and others are interested in understanding, well, what does that investment look like and what do the practices look like? So we've had our first round of disclosures. We've got another round that are coming out. But that's the genesis of it. So again, it's only for public companies. There's some state laws that are sort of in the mix looking at disclosures for businesses over a certain size, California in particular. But that's sort of the idea, is through the SEC helping investors principally, but I think also the public who are paying very close attention to this in certain pockets, really understand how companies treat their workers.
So kind of tying in that HCM concept with the ESG and how consumers are becoming much more aware of who they're buying from or doing business with from that standpoint. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And again, I think, you know, I think one of the challenges that's also out there is like the ever shifting acronym universe and where do they relate? Like
human capital resources and the acronyms, you know, you and I could spend all day talking about OFCCP, VADA, FMLA.
Yeah, it's, you know, the alphabet soup of just jargon, which I think is, you know, sometimes sort of you lose the forest through the trees with that. But the general and human capital management, of course, is a term of art with, you know, others use it in context, but same with ESG, you know, it's a term of art that's housed initially in sort of corporate social responsibility offices, working its way more into CFO strategies as well as investor relations, et cetera. So there's going to be continue to be permutations. But I think the point you raise, which is really, I think, the cornerstone of why these are making their way through it, is not only an increased recognition that, you know, how organizations treat their workers matters in business performance. We have not nearly enough metrics to really understand that yet. And I think that's part of the challenges of this. And I know we'll talk about HR data and the perils of that. But I also think it's the larger point, which is more of the consuming public are interested in the brands they're buying from, how those brands engage in the world, and what those brands stand for. And I think we had early sort of brands coming out making all of these wonderful statements about all the things that they believe in. And so these disclosures are, I think, an attempt to say, okay, great, you say you believe in these things. Now show us what you've done. And I think that's where we are now, is, you know, it's easy to get those statements into the market. And I think now the next phase is, okay, well, how are you actually manifesting those statements? And so I think that's, you know, frankly, it's a tension point that we see, because it's not as easy to always align, you know, aspirational statements with tangible actions. And that's, I think, what the human capital management disclosures are aimed at, is what are the tangible things you've done to actually align with the value that you're putting into the market.
So that leads to kind of, and you're actually, I think you've hinted at, if I'm going to straight out ask, I mean, so we've gone through one round of reporting. Was the data that was received by the SEC helpful in understanding how companies are investing in its team or its personnel?
It varied, but I think in total, no, it was not. And again, I don't think that should be taken as a criticism necessarily of those companies. for the very reasons that you've prohibited me from talking about until now, which is, you know, the dirty secret is that HR data stinks.
Yeah.
It stinks the way it's collected. It stinks the way it's analyzed, and it stinks the way it can actually be leveraged for insight. And so I'm not surprised that the human capital management disclosures didn't have a lot of information, because I think employers struggle to get credible information from their people data. And so absent that, like, I'm not surprised that we don't have great insights. I don't think it's because you've got nefarious actors on either side. I think it's really a practical challenge of, we just got really bad data systems.
So, I mean, people are going to be surprised, because they're going to say, Tawny, your job as a lawyer is you're always just telling us what we can't do. But I hope for those who have worked with me and maybe in the past have worked with Matt, they know that we're not those types of lawyers. And instead, our goal is to help to come up with solutions, whether or not straightforward solutions, creative solutions. So, Matt, as it relates, we just identified a problem. You've just identified kind of a problem. But the cool news is I know that you've given it some thought and you've come up with ways that we can figure out a solution. So you've mentioned that there's at least four key considerations that should be considered by an organization to effectively track HCM. The first one is add data scientists to your team. What do you mean? I mean, are we taking IT, or are we getting a mathematician and adding them to our HR team? Is that truly what you want us to do, or what do you mean by that?
And I'll give a crude answer, then I'll expand. But yeah, I think that makes a ton of sense. I mean, what? So I go back to this again, the statements that are being put out into the public, which about how important the workforce is, how it's the most important asset, it's a key priority, yet it's the place where we see the least amount of insight. I can't imagine any successful business that would say, hey, we're not going to try to understand what's happening with our most important asset. And so to me, the way to do that is to look at how are other aspects of your business that do data collection, that do rely on stats, that do rely on those things, how are they functioning? And largely it's with the advent of data expertise. And I think HR has long not had dedicated analyst or statistical expertise within their frameworks. They're borrowing from other parts of the business, particularly finance and other places. I think that is not, you know, I don't think that's the most efficient way to do it, because you're always going to be sharing time. I also think that there's emerging insights around HR analytics, and you're seeing programs coming up, helping organizations. One of the fastest growing jobs in HR is actually data analysts. I think you're seeing more organizations rethinking their people data strategy. How are they setting up relationships with vendors that are capturing data? How are they thinking about warehousing data? How are they thinking about leveraging that for insights? And so to me, like, I don't think we're going to see meaningful insights at scale through any sort of human capital disclosures or any people data until HR sort of gets its own data self in line. And to me, that's a shift in the way that HR leaders view their role within organizations. It's no longer just about the compliance aspects or the training and organizational development. If they're not thinking that their role is also to be in the people analytics business, then I think that they are missing a huge opportunity to be more efficient, to have more cost-effective programs, and to really start putting in place the things that will tangibly matter to their workers. So yeah, I think there needs to be a data revolution with how HR views its role and function. And that requires expertise that often doesn't exist in HR today.
The second element that you mentioned as being key is to start with the end in mind. And I think that there's a lot of attorneys who are cringing when I say that. And they're like, wait a second, Matt, you know that that's risky. What do you mean when you say start with the end in mind?
Well, this is part of the reason why I'm a recovered lawyer.
Yeah,
I'm in the
solution clearly.
Business, not the obstruction business. But so, like, I think when I say what to start with the end in mind is, I mean this in the specific context of what story do you want to understand? And recognizing that within any organization, you have multiple audiences, right? So you've got your executives, you've got your frontline managers, you've got your frontline workers, you may or may not have investors depending upon your business. And each of those folks are going to be interested in different insights. And I'll share an example of this. So we've been working with a large manufacturing company, and they are helping them with some of their assessment programs for their workforce. And one of the things that we encourage them to do, and they did, is to say, hey, as you're doing these assessments, as data comes in, you need to have a real-time dashboard that is available to your senior leaders so that they in real time have the ability to interact with this. And we worked with them to design on what does the dashboard need to look like? What are the elements that should go to that? And that has had a significant impact on that organization. They are changing some of their benefit directions. They are adding new programs. They're reframing the conversations they want to have with them. And it was really not based upon, you know, providing them with data that is potentially compromising. You know, I'm a big advocate for disaggregating data across demographic lines. I get it's dicey. I understand it. Don't necessarily have to start there if you know your risk profile is not going to allow that, or certainly lots of folks do that under the attorney-client privilege in order to protect that data. I get all of that, but I don't think that organization should, and I'll just say bluntly, should use their lawyers as an excuse not to try to understand what's happening with their workforce. Because I think doing a disservice to their clients.
This is that moment where I'm supposed to cut your mic off. But no, I do agree with you, Matt. And, you know, I never want to forestall kind of evolution. And my goal is to help a client achieve whatever their goals are. And if that's evolution, I want to be helpful in helping that to occur. We do need to take a quick break. You're listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, Tawny Alvarez from Verrill, and today our guest is Matt Ball, Vice President, Workplace Market Lead at Financial Health Network. And we've spent the last 40 minutes talking about all things money as it relates to, I think, employees and employee well-being, whether or not that's livable wage, whether or not it's how that data is used to make strategic decisions moving forward. And prior to the break, Matt, you talked extensively about data. And, you know, we made jokes at the end there about the importance in some situations of understanding the demographics behind data. And to me, that becomes a really important element of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And when we have discussions concerning DEI efforts, if an organization is unwilling to collect the data, then it's very difficult to move forward, whether or not it's with an affirmative action plan that is required under state or federal law, or one that the organization is choosing to enter into based off of review of data. But at the same time, I feel as though before the data is created, before the data is collected, we need to get senior leadership on board that they're going to take action when they see what the results are. Because I think from my standpoint, when we're talking about risk management, the biggest risk here is having the data and evidence that you did nothing with it. I mean, do you see a way for employers, other than just saying, we promise we'll make the time in the same way that we promise we'll make the widgets. I mean, is there an easy road here to figure out how to use the data, or is it really senior leadership has to say this is a priority and then follow through with that?
Yeah, I guess I take a slightly different perspective on that, in the sense that I never encourage organizations to commit to a course of action until they've seen the data. I think it's irresponsible for leaders to communicate they're going to do something without knowing what the best course of action is. So that's number one. Like, I don't think you can ask senior leaders to say, we are committed to doing X, a specific thing. But I do think my experience is once senior leaders see the data, many times they may have assumptions about what that data would be. And generally it's counter to what their assumptions are. These are folks that, by and large, in my experience, care about their people. They care about the success of their business. They care about a multitude of stakeholders. And seeing what's happening with the workforce and where there are gaps and deficiencies drives action. I think a public example of this is Dan Shulman at PayPal. We have a long relationship with PayPal. And Dan has been a real champion of really seeking to understand what's happening with the workforce. They paid above market rates. They had great benefits. And when they actually engaged in that dialogue and that interaction with their workforce, they discovered they had some deficiencies, that maybe the way that they were setting their wages wasn't actually based in a way that was beneficial to some of their lower wage workers, the way that they were allocating some of their spends. Now, Dan didn't go into that and PayPal didn't go into that. And this is public. There are case studies, including on our website, about this. I don't think they went into that thinking that, oh, we have a specific course of action. I think they went thinking like, hey, we should know about this. And now there's obviously the line with PayPal's business. And so there were things of that nature that did that. But I think they were surprised with some of the things that they saw. And they used that to set out a course over a multitude of years in which to set those targets. So for me, the data collection is not about responding immediately to an action. It's about using that data to then set an appropriate course for your future actions you want to take. I don't know of any company that would be able, willing, or practically possible to solve all the potential challenges in one fell swoop. But not having a plan and winging it is a surefire way to guarantee that nothing will improve, that you'll continue to have the same issues year over year. And so to me, there's an element of courage in this, which is the courage to know what's happening. And then once they know what's happening, exercising those leadership skills that ascended people to those positions to be responsive. You don't have to solve everything in one fell swoop, but you do a disservice to your shareholders, to your business partners, and to your workers if you think that the ostrich approach to workplace and HR management is going to be effective in the long run.
And with that word of wisdom, that we don't act like ostriches in the workplace and that it won't be accomplished in one fell swoop, that's the end of our program today. Matt, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a wonderful discussion. I very much enjoyed it. And as always, I appreciate your willingness to be a guest on the show.
Always a pleasure. I'm glad we can make this work with our schedules. And just thanks to the listening audience. And if anyone's interested, you can check out our website at finhealthnetwork.org. We've got all sorts of research. Again, we're a nonprofit, so much of our insights are public. And if you'd like to have a conversation about any of these things, Tani knows how to get in touch with me, but you can also reach out to me through the website.
Thanks, Matt. You've been listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.